CliffCentral.com.
So let us welcome someone who might be able to help us figure out our way through this year, because it's going to, you know, it's going to be up, it's going to be down, it's going to be like any other year. And in order to help us figure things out, we've got Cobus Rousseau here. He is a special practitioner in all kinds of things. Hypnotist, he's a relationship guy, he's a mentoring guy, coaching guy, healing guy. Helps you find the emotional solutions and add some positivity to your life. It sounds like the most awesome job description in the world.
It's a great job.
Yeah.
I get to help people.
Yeah, absolutely. And what kind of things do people ask you to do for them? Because you seem like you could do a lot of things. What do they come to you with?
Well, you've got everything from somebody in their mid-60s who went through a very abusive relationship 20 years ago, struggling to get into a new relationship. And
what do you say to those people? Viagra?
Well, it depends. In this case, female. So, the abusive relationship kind of led her into a place where for 20 years she had no intimacy with anybody. And that's a difficult job to get somebody from that position into something where they feel they can trust somebody again.
But now, Corbis, it must be tough to, because you're almost like fulfilling the role of a therapist in some ways.
Yeah.
But you don't have to be a qualified therapist. Sometimes you're just someone who they can talk to, someone who they can unload on, and you've got some case studies and some life experience to apply.
Yeah, I think the first thing is listening. You have to be a very good listener. You have to be willing to listen to somebody for hours sometimes. When I initially started in this, I used to see people for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I quickly figured out an hour is just not enough.
But then you also have to break down those walls, because why would you trust a stranger with this stuff? You know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, rapport is essential.
Yeah.
Trust. Integrity. Somebody needs to know that whatever they tell me stays with me. For instance, if I'm doing relationship work, somebody comes to me and says, look, our marriage is on the rocks, we're struggling with things here. If I'm seeing both parties, either party might tell me something that the other party doesn't need to hear, and I need to keep that
very quiet.
And you're
not allowed to tell.
Yeah.
Do you have anyone who you can unload on?
Yeah.
I mean, otherwise you're going to end up like this.
Look, I've always
been quite repository of energy, and it's not always going to be good.
No, and there is that risk. The first thing is, I've always been very deliberate about maintaining a network of mentors myself. I make sure that I find people that I either admire for the way they are doing things, or that I know that they do things badly.
Okay.
Because knowing people that do things badly isn't a bad thing either. You need to know somebody that screws things up, otherwise you can't avoid that. Right? I mean,
sure.
my uncle was my big lesson there.
Oh yeah, why was he a disaster?
He was such a good man, but part of his goodness was that he just gave too much of himself. You know, so he managed to give away most of his things and leave a lot of people in trouble at the end of the day. So when you're being kind, you also have to know that unless you yourself are looked after, you can't be kind to others.
So how did you get into this? Because, if you told your parents when you were a kid, I'm going to become an invisible wingman and, personal assistant in emotional and healing and relationship situations, they would have said to you, go to university, get a job.
Well, yeah, I mean, that did happen. and my dad, who might be listening, will remember him putting the forms down in front of me, going, sign there, and me going, what's that? And he said, that's the BCom you're going to study next year. Where I wanted to study psychology.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so after failing BCom for 2 years in a row, because if you don't want to do something, it's very difficult to do it, I then enrolled into psychology, did that for 3 years, and then
loved
in honors
that, right.
year, I enjoyed it, but I, talking to others, I quickly realized that if you were in University X, you were Jungian, and if you were in University Y, you were Freudian.
Right.
And it just seemed to me like nobody was integrating all of these streams into something coherent, which is odd.
Mm.
Because you're entrusted with somebody's mental health.
Exactly. You should be as open to ideas as possible.
And we have all these disparate ideas running around. So having done the honors, or halfway through honors, I just thought, no, wait a minute.
Not for you.
I'm out of here.
Yeah.
And then for several years, I did things like wash engines.
That's a nasty joke. I can't imagine washing engines.
I still can't handle the smell
of diesel. How long did you do that?
3 years.
Oh, my God. Washing engines?
Well, there was nothing going for somebody with a BA psychology.
Wow.
I hear stories now of people, you know, coming out of varsity and not getting employment. And I think, yeah.
Go wash engines.
Well, look, I was lucky. And I think we must be careful when we say things like, you know, just go and get a job. There are some lucky breaks that you need in life,
right? But don't you, Corvus, don't you also think like a lot of us are raised these days, and there are plenty of people under the age of 30 in South Africa who've been told, you can be anything you want to be, you can do anything you want to do, but the reality is that you can't. Well, no one's going to pay you to do what you really love if you're average at it, and there's no market for it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I often say that we've got a generation that was raised by parents who didn't understand the difference between special and unique. We're all unique. But honestly, there are only so many Newtons, so many Baldwins. They don't come around every generation.
So are you saying maybe we've, because this is, I blame Oprah. I blame Oprah. She used to
no,
say,
no, you can't segue from somewhere where we shouldn't be blaming people and
no,
go straight into blaming
I'm
going to
blame
someone.
Oprah. She deserves this one fair and square, because she said everybody's special. Your best is good enough. If you do your best, then no one can possibly have a problem with you. That's not true in everything.
Yeah,
is
although
it?
She was just parroting a zeitgeist. I mean, we all, you know, the 90s and the 2000s were a lot around, you know, if you believe in it absolutely. I mean, for goodness sake, The Secret.
You know, if you see it, you can achieve
it. You ask a universe that average temperatures just above zero Kelvin for something and it gives it to you. I hate to tell people this, but at that macro level, the universe is just a cold, hostile place. Life exists in a tiny band on this planet.
And you don't believe in The Secret.
I burn a copy once a year. because it's fundamentally, I mean, at a starting point, it's sort of premised on selfishness.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask for something.
And someone's going to help me get it, yeah.
I mean, if ever there was a sort of anthropocentric philosophy, that's got to be it. And surely we've left that behind. I mean, we must know by now that we are not central to the whole thing. We're alive, we're human, we're amazing.
Yeah, the miracle is our existence.
Astonishing things. But, and more and more I'm thinking that one of the fundamental mistakes we made was 20th century and this complete obsession with the self. It's realized in many different
things. It's
made us
so self-absorbed.
Yeah, but,
right?
You know, I mean, it's in everything. It's in our economic theory where, you know, it's the pursuit of the individual, etc. And we've forgotten that we're herd animals. We're really good in groups. You send one of us onto the savannah and it's going to be dead in a day. You send three into the savannah, we'll have a village in a year.
Yeah.
And if we can cooperate, it's better.
Absolutely. It's the only way we've got to where we are.
Yeah.
Cooperation. Yeah. Okay, so
$7 billion.
So what's your? I mean, what's the philosophy that you like to implement? You said Jungian on one side and Freudian on the other when it comes to psychology. But I mean, how do you see the world? Maybe the way you see the world could help us to figure it out for ourselves.
Well, I think starting point for me would always be scientific method, and that revolves around not so much experimentation, etc., but let's say I believe very strongly that Ayn Rand had everything, you know.
Yeah,
she put it down for us.
Capitalist manifesto.
Objectivism.
Yeah, okay.
So when I then go out and I seek to find all the evidence that supports my theory, then basically I'm just religious.
Yes.
But when I go out and I seek all the evidence that disproves my theory, then I'm being scientific, right? And it's quite easy if you're a capitalist and you're looking for evidence that it doesn't work to find the evidence that it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy. And the same goes for communism, etc. Big problem then is you quickly run into this this strange idea that just about everything we've tried to date doesn't work. Right? And yet we all have this nostalgia. Communists will talk about, yeah, well, the reason why it didn't work is, or capitalists will say, well, the reason why it didn't work is because, and all of them say because the situation wasn't perfect. Well, I hate to break this to them, but
it never
will be, right? It just cannot be. Humans are good at gaming systems. So the moment you develop one system to guide them, they will find a way to trick it to their benefit. You have to constantly adapt. You cannot hold some ideology as all-serving, all-defeating.
Well, now in America, you can see it more than ever. I mean, because people on the right are all thrilled about Donald Trump, and they think he's going to be the solution to all their problems, the strong man idea.
Well, I think if you go into the detail, there's a lot of people on the right who aren't happy but are caught in a very bad place.
Look, there are various reasons, but there are a lot of those people who are very they're excited about the prospect of this fringe, non-establishment, strong man who's going to make completely unpredictable moves.
Yeah.
And just show a middle finger to the rest of the world. Then you get those people who are very butthurt that Hillary didn't win and that, you know, identity politics is dead.
I don't know if identity politics is dead. I think it has a large role to play in what we decide about the future. And I think when you're looking at the scenario we've got going ahead globally, it's actually pretty bad. And I think we have to acknowledge that.
Corbis, I thought you were going to come in here and make us feel better, and all you've done so far is just depress us.
Well, yeah, maybe. but we have to have a starting point, and if I could solve everybody's problems in a minute, I would. I really would.
You were about to say, though, Rich said, and I interrupted.
Well, Rich touched on a few things. The first is being realistic. There's no point in saying, well, none of this will affect us. I mean, we're in economic trouble as a planet. And more specifically ourselves, because at the end of it, I live here, so this is my team. I'm part of Team South Africa, and standing around shouting when somebody drops the ball doesn't get the ball picked up and the try scored. Mm. We're really good at pointing out everybody's errors, though.
We love it.
Oh, yeah, I know.
We're quality controllers,
I think.
But what is that where do we get satisfaction out of that? I don't understand it. I don't take that much pleasure in pointing out idiots.
Yeah, I think it's partly because as humans we love righteousness. We do want to feel that we're morally good. And, you know, pointing out somebody else's failures gives us that temporary high of, oh, wow, look at it.
I'm not so bad.
Yeah. I mean, if you've ever been an employer, I'm sure you've had people come to you and say, hey, do you know what so-and-so did? And I used to say to my guys, I'm not even interested. What did you do to help that person?
Mm.
How did you fix the situation? Because me knowing this right now doesn't help. I mean, the past and hashing over the past is great if you've got a time machine, but without a time machine, what's the point?
There's no point.
There really isn't any point. If you've learned something from it, that's great. So Rich said, be realistic. We've got to be realistic.
Okay.
Some tough times ahead, interesting ones. However, that also means that there are opportunities ahead. If America does what it does under somebody who is proof of the failures of capitalism, if anybody. I mean, you've got a fool who's made a lot of money. That shouldn't work, right?
Right.
No, he is.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure he'll sue me, but that's okay. He usually drops those cases. So we've got to know the tough times ahead, but there is a positive in it for us down here because we're a long way away from that. We're sitting on the doorstep of a massive market. Mm-hmm. Africa's a growing continent.
Yeah.
The population bulge is sitting around the 16 to 25-year-olds. And if you know anything about economics, it's that you follow that bulge and you'll find the money. So we are headed towards an economic boom, and it's right on our doorstep. We need to start looking at our own market as well. You know, Siya Masuku that did the pamphlet for
Right.
So vernacular publishing, for instance. Why aren't we writing books in isiZulu?
Yeah.
In Tshivenda?
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine, he was a great programmer, computer programmer, brilliant guy. And he left his business and tried some farming up in Toyandu. And he was looking around, and being a businessman, he was always looking for opportunity. He realized that there's just kids everywhere. So he opened a toy store in Toyandu.
Right.
He's now got three toy stores in Toyandu and another one in Bramley outside of Alex.
Right.
I'm not saying he's printing money.
But he's doing damn well.
But he's putting three kids through private school.
Nice.
Which, you know, I mean, if anybody knows what those costs are, that's expensive. So he's doing okay. And those markets exist. If we start printing the books, the readers will come.
You sent me a quote from Ben Okri.
Yeah.
Listen to this quickly, and then we'll talk about it. To poison a nation, poison its stories. A demoralized nation tells demoralized stories to itself. Beware of the storytellers who are not fully conscious of the importance of their gifts and who are irresponsible in the application of their art. You want me to read it again?
Mm.
Okay. To poison a nation, poison its stories. A demoralized nation tells demoralized stories to itself. Beware the storytellers who are not fully conscious of the importance of their gifts and who are irresponsible in the application of their art. That's Ben Okri. So, why is this quote important to you?
Because, I mean, especially in the South African context, if ever there was a demoralized nation telling itself demoralizing stories, it is us. Mm. Yeah, I think it's true around the place, but we are so good at it. We attach a lot of importance to anything that raises our blood pressure, but not always to the things that move us through their beauty.
We love bad news. We love knocking things. We love saying how crappy people are. We love
a nation of
auditors. Mediocrity. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, quality controllers. We find all the faults, but we don't really come up with solutions. And I think what we need is to start telling the stories about our successes. But more importantly, we need to start getting an idea of where do we want to go? Who do we want to be? Because after the realism, there has to be a moment when you go, okay, but where do I want to be? Because if you don't know where you're going,
how will
all
you know,
roads
how
will
you
lead
know
you there.
You got there, yeah.
Yeah. And it's a fundamental flaw, I think, in our current thinking that we don't actually have a definition of where we're going. And part of that is because we've adopted some neoliberal models which are technocratic. They say that if you do the right things, prosperity follows. But it doesn't. I mean, it hasn't anywhere.
Mm.
Because part of that was, you know, do what people want rather than what they need.
Yeah.
And we need to start doing what people need rather than what they want. But more importantly, we need to know, well, what does the future look like? Where are we in 100 years? What does the country look like? And I'm not saying that I know.
Do you think anybody has an idea?
Well, I think the people who've got the platform don't. But I think...
And are they our bad storytellers?
They're not even telling stories. I mean, it's part of the thing about leaders that are charismatic is that when they tell stories, they make us believe.
Mm-hmm.
And people will do for ideas what they won't do for money. Right? You can pay soldiers, but make them believe in freedom and they will do horrible things. Make them believe that they're self-righteous and they'll do incredible things.
Mm.
And we're not really defining where we're going. We're not casting a vision. And a leader should be doing that. A leader should make you perform better than you can.
Isn't our language also so paltry? Like, we talk about a democratic, non-racial South Africa as if that's a goal. Like, that should be a given.
Well,
democratic, well, that's what we've got. That's the system of government we've chosen. Non-racial, well, we should be like that in our best moments and our worst.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous that those low standards are the standards that we have for what our greatest aspirations as a country should be.
Exactly.
For God's sake, what should we have? We should have the greatest infrastructure in Africa. We should have jobs for everyone. We should have every single person involved in civic society.
Yeah.
Those are things that we should aim for. Those are goals, right? Those are bold ambitions.
And we should define...
A democratic, non-racial, non-sexist society, as if nons make you something.
Well, I mean, that's a sort of fundamental NLP principle that we can't process negatives, right?
Oh.
I mean, our brains don't work that way. So when I tell you not to think about a yellow Volkswagen...
All you think about is a yellow Volkswagen.
So if we say non, it doesn't process, and we just reinforce the message that we are this... We're not putting something else in its place. You know, you need to move something else in that space and say we want to be X, Y, and Z. Now, I mean, I'm a guy who works with individuals. I haven't run a country, but from everywhere that I've ever looked, it looks complex.
It does. Yeah. And, sure it is.
And the problem also is that in our own language, in opposition to government, we simplify. We take something that is ludicrously complex and we make it very simple. We will say things like, they haven't done anything. Well, if I'm being scientific and I say, well, did they do anything? Well, they've done a lot.
Yeah.
Built more houses than any other government in the history of mankind. Literally.
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to give people credit that nobody wants to give credit to, but it's there. Right? So we're throwing a lot of babies out with a lot of dishwater. We need to keep some of that, but we really need to start thinking about where are we going. I mean, those are the conversations we should have. Where are we going? What does it look like? And then we can plot how we get there.
So when you sit down with an individual, you have these conversations.
Yeah.
Where do you even begin with that?
Well, I like stories, right? So, and most people, when you say to them, tell me something about yourself, they'll start. And then it's just being curious. And I'm fortunate that I find all people interesting. Okay. I mean, some people are very interesting, but everybody's got something inside of them. And I think part of the reason why I, after many years in IT, went back into this was, this is what I enjoy doing. I see things in people. I can see potential. And helping people take that potential and turn it into reality is a very exciting thing to do. You know, the journey with Sia from where he was to bringing out Siyafunda isiZulu.
Mm.
Come on, if that's your job, helping somebody do that, that's amazing.
I didn't realize, because we had Sia Masuku in here a while ago, and he brought the book in, showed us what he'd done. And I mean, it was terrific to see, you know, here's this guy who really has the opportunity here to make a real change and to allow thousands, if not millions of people to learn a language and to learn the basics of a form of communication, which is imperiled in a world of kind of English, Spanish and Chinese.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of where it's going.
But you see, that's another one of those.
There isn't enough publication in those languages.
Yeah, but you know, we make a mistake. We say things to people, you know, you've probably heard it, English is the language of business. Last week, there's this video that went across Facebook of this Chinese guy speaking isiZulu, and he's got two taverns in Durban. You need to tell him that English is the language of business, because he's figured out that in here, English is not necessary. So what we're doing is we're making a hell of a lot of kids confused about what, who, where, what, how. We're stunting their intellectual growth by putting them 2 years behind. And then we end up saying to them, well, why aren't you getting something? We need to make hard decisions about things that will cost an enormous amount of money. But if we don't do them, they will cost much more.
What do you say to people who are just very self-destructive? They come to you and they go, look, I've exhausted everything else. I've been to the psychiatrist. I've been to the financial planner. I've been to the relationship counselor. I find myself at your door now. But you can tell that this is the sort of person who's just, they're unable to, first of all, countenance their own insecurities and their own weaknesses, let's say. And they go around hurting people, whether it's intentional or not, it happens. And there are a lot of people like that in the world. What do you say to get them on the first steps to kind of fixing their life? Because that's a hard task.
You know, your first problem is that there's no one way with any human. I'd say that there's at least 7 billion ways to fix humans on the planet at the moment, right? And for each person, there's going to be an individual thing. And I always think of it as... you know, I like fishing.
Okay.
And fly fishing
is fishing. Horrible. Really? You do? You spend a lot of time doing that, a lot of time
waiting.
Well,
when you're flailing a fly rod around, it's very difficult for somebody to talk to you, and it's nice and quiet.
So it's the peace and solitude.
Yeah, more than anything else. But, you know, every now and again in your fishing line, you'll get this bundle of knots, right?
Okay.
And years ago, I was stuck on a mountaintop, beautiful lake, fish going crazy, and all I've got is this line, and now it's bunched up. So I thought, well, I've got nothing else to do, and I want these fish, so I'm going to unpick it, because that's the kind of thing you usually just cut away. And what I found, taking the time about it, was that if I pulled too hard at something, I just tightened the knot. But But if I teased at it, eventually I found one place that when I loosened that, everything else started unraveling. And people are a bit like that, right? We grow up and somebody shouts at us when we do something. They made a mistake. They misinterpreted it. We keep hearing that voice. Every time we repeat that action, we hear that voice, that parent screaming at us or teacher telling us.
Tighten up.
Yeah. So what you want to do is you want to go in there and start pulling gently at places until you find that knot. And when you pull it, quite often everything just
opens up.
Yeah. So you can have astounding results if you're patient, very deliberate, and you pay a lot of attention very quickly. Every now and again, you're going to find somebody that's just incorrigible. And usually that's somebody that gets sent to you, right?
Yeah. I mean, they don't come willingly.
Yeah. Every now and again, you get somebody coming to you willingly. But it's odd in relationships how often the man's the problem, the woman comes to you and asks you to fix the man.
Please help this guy.
Yeah, and if they're not there willingly, it's very difficult. That means that I need to take 6 or 7 sessions to get them to the point where they go, hey, yeah, you could help me. Because if they don't
think...
Why don't we think?
Why don't we listen? Why don't we open up easily? Is it just damage from when we're little kids and...
Well, I think we all want to feel like we're doing the right thing. And we also have a sort of fetish for naturalism, you know. It's got to be natural. It must just happen, you know. Something must be spontaneous. I don't want to be deliberate about this. You know, we don't make occasions. They must just occur. How often do we turn to nature for ethical guidance?
Yeah.
And how horrible is that?
Nature's mean.
It's not mean.
Nature doesn't give you ethical guidance.
It's oblivious to the idea of ethics.
It doesn't care. Not even your own DNA cares what happens.
When the
to
meteor
you.
Goes through this planet, at no point is it going to go, should I do this?
Should we save those creatures of the long necks?
Yeah, is it worthwhile? So, you know, this idea that we can turn to nature for any lessons is absurd.
Nature does not care about
no.
you.
No. Caring, mercy, kindness, those are all human inventions. I have no idea why we hate ourselves so much. If we can come up with that stuff, it's bizarre. And yet we do. We think that it comes from somewhere else, but it comes from us. It's extraordinary. So, you know, sometimes people just think that, you know, they must be natural and this is the way they are. And, well, we all fear change, right?
Yeah. Well, that's part of the problem. I started this morning saying that we're going to change a few things on the show, and Mabali and I had a conversation about how whenever you mention change, people go,
yeah.
Like it's, you know, this is going to be hard.
Don't ruin my routine. I'm so comfortable in it now. I'm so used to it.
You know, managing that change is a massive thing. I mean, 15 years in IT, and a lot of what we did was implement large systems into organizations, and you will get people sabotaging you, you know, because they just don't want the change. Or, you know, even in the office, you say to people, we're going to change a few things. A week later, somebody comes to you and, should I be updating my CV? You're like, we just posted the best results we had in 10 years and we're going to buy a new kitchen. What did you think was going to happen? But, you know, then there's the fact that we just kind of end up loving our routines. We end up loving where we are, and we don't want to abandon it.
All right, but we're at the start of a new year now. So it gives a lot of people pause to reflect. Everybody feels pressurized to be a new them, a new year. Everything must be out with the old, in with the new. That's not healthy either.
No. Again, going back to that sort of rah-rah, Oprah kind of thing that was happening, I think we kind of overdid that. We sold a lot of people this idea that we would teach them some great success. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, somebody wants to be a multimillionaire, good for them. But there's a lot of people who don't want that. You know, they're quite happy being accountants. And they hate the fact that people keep on talking about them as grey and uninteresting.
Or spiritual healers or, you know, crystal... There might be artisans. There might be people who make tobacco pipes.
Yeah. And what's wrong with that?
Nothing.
I mean, you might just want to make a better tobacco pipe, or you might be making tobacco pipes, but you're not quite happy with how you are thinking about something, or you're struggling with some specific aspect of interpersonal relationships. So that goes back to that realism. Who are you? Who do you want to be? And then how do we get you there?
And no one can decide that stuff except you.
Yeah. You know, sometimes it's good to have somebody to sit with and go, okay, I'm thinking of the following. Am I being realistic? Can I set this goal? Can I take it somewhere? And then for somebody to kind of test that. You know, it's one of the reasons why I don't like working on my own if I was to pursue some sort of corporate thing, because it's too easy to just start falling in love with your own method, you know.
Yeah.
You need somebody who goes, oh, guy, you're getting a little bit big for your boots, right? We need to do the following and hit it there. I'm not saying we shouldn't have unrealistic dreams. Those also fuel change. And then, you know, if you need, find a guide. Find somebody who can help you.
Is that where your wingman and sidekick come into things? So explain the sidekick, because I love that job title. It's the thing that got me interested in the first place. Your invisible sidekick and professional wingman. So what are those titles? And not just in respect of what you do, but in terms of how everybody needs something like that in their lives, because it's clearly fulfilling a gap.
Yeah.
Many of us are living, even if we're in relationships, even if we're in families, we're living very solitary lives.
Well, we've become atomized, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we're completely isolated from everything. And we struggle inside of that because we've also become very secretive. You know, privacy is a big thing now. For most of humanity, it never existed. It was an odd idea. I think we brought somebody from Elizabethan England. They think, whoa.
Privacy, yeah.
What are you talking about?
You would just take a shit right next to someone. They did. People used to do that. They'd sit on a long bench with a hole in it, and everybody would take a shit together.
Yeah, a hotel was a big room, and everybody just slept. And if you were lucky enough to get lucky, you got lucky in between everybody, and that was it.
Right.
But I think in that atomization, right, we've lost some things that in the past you might have gone to an uncle to talk to something, or, you know, you'd have a voice encouraging you. So the invisible sidekick, there is obviously an observer effect, right? And you're familiar with the observer effect.
Yeah, this is the...
In the same way, somebody comes to me with an issue.
It's relativity.
They talk to me, and now they know that there's somebody who next week will follow up on, did we do, right? And then you kind of have just that little bit of additional pressure, because we're kind to ourselves. We can be unkind to ourselves.
Let me break it into language I understand. So I'm sure I understand you right. So I can go to gym and I can train on my own, but I'm never going to push myself as hard as if I have a coach.
Yeah. I mean, I've been toying with the idea of like mental gyms, right?
Yeah.
Where we can get together, we can discuss some ideas. We can talk about where we want to head as a society. We can discuss what we're reading. I mean, I'm big on reading. Somebody comes to me and
I don't mean to interrupt you, but a lot of what we do here and a lot of what I want to do on this show is precisely that, a mental gym. Sure. Well, we test ideas.
Yeah.
We take a concept that is universally loved or hated, or certainly universally understood in terms of its basic fundamental principles. And then we tear it apart at basic principles. So we say, well, what is this idea of scapegoating, for example, from this morning? Or the idea of believing in a father figure in the sky? Or the idea of money being all-important and all-consuming? And we take these things to pieces with smart people every week. That's the kind of thing that would really – I consider myself to be someone who's not particularly needy. But I would love to be a part of that every day.
Oh, yeah, me too. I mean, nothing more exciting than to test ideas and investigate them and shove them around a bit.
Yeah.
Money is a very interesting one. You can have long talk about that.
I'd love to get into things like that. And also the idea of kind of masculinity and maleness and how that's changed. We couldn't even have sat here, you and I, 50 years ago and had this conversation. We would have been the world's greatest pussies. To even have conversations about anything to do with feelings, anything to do with anything that wasn't clinical, academic, or violent.
Okay, I'm not sure that that's historically correct. I think you'd have to go a bit further than 50 years. But, yeah, it has changed, and we've fundamentally changed, and I think for the better. And I think there's some change still needed. What interests me is why it feels so threatened, something that holds itself so strong and so macho. And you say to them, well, somebody else is going to use the bathroom, and they're all melting and crying themselves.
What, someone is at a sex change or something?
Really? What
yeah.
the hell?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or a gay guy walks into a room and a whole lot of supposedly strong straight males all go, oh my God, it's the gay guy. We better protect our assholes.
Yeah.
Yes, because the thing about gay guys is they always want the straight men.
Yeah, and they go
they
straight
always for, want they, the straight
mumps,
guys.
Mumps, they barrel down on you, go straight for your asshole. You have no control. You have no way
these
of stopping.
These poor straight men.
Yeah, I know. It is weird. There is this funny thing going on in society at the moment where it's almost become the strongest thing you can be is a victim. Like victimhood has become a badge of courage. And victimhood, and you hear it. You heard Meryl Streep earlier. She was busy talking about it. This one was born in a cabin in the woods. And this one made it out of rural Iowa. As if these stories, these badges of how hard we've struggled are the things that must define us forevermore. And weakness and being subject to someone else's rules for such a long time makes you somehow noble. And, you know, having poverty in your life for thousands of years and in all your ancestors' lives suddenly makes you entitled to more in this life. It's very bizarre. It's we have a strange way of looking at the world and figuring our place in it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's collective. But we're also in a situation where we're becoming more and more polarized. So because our discourse is less about finding common ground, but more about establishing our own grounds for anger or whatever, what happens is every time we get countered, we double down. And this is happening on both sides. Sides of this debate. Instead of at some stage going, okay, let me introspect for a second, where am I going with this, and does this lead to something positive? It's just, I'm being attacked, I need to double down and hit back. And yes, there are romanticized notions in terms of victimhood, but there's also romanticized notions around success. We presume that somebody is wealthy. I had this on Saturday at a funeral where some lady said, yeah, well, he's a good businessman. Well, no, he actually isn't. Not really. I mean, there's that thing that if he took the $1 million his dad gave him and just put it on the stock market, he'd have double the wealth now. If he hadn't declared bankruptcy, I don't know, twice, three times?
Yeah.
You know what bankruptcy is. That's ringing up everybody and then dumping everybody that you owe money to.
Correct.
That's a nice way to run a business.
But it's certainly not an indicator of success.
Not at all.
In any way, shape, or form, yeah. No matter how Donald tries to
spin. And we can talk about whether being a landlord is an indication of success.
Because that's what he is. He's a property mogul.
He's a property mogul.
You know, I think we've only scratched the surface. I actually, when I saw what you did and I read those bylines, I thought we might head in one or two directions. We haven't even gotten those. I mean, we didn't talk about hypnotherapy. We didn't talk about mentoring.
Sure.
Healing. I mean, you say that, for example.
Sia says. I don't do my own marketing. My clients do my marketing.
So is this Sia Masuku who put this together for you?
Yeah, yeah.
But this is an amazing thing because it almost looks like those ads where you can increase the length of someone's penis.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right,
Mumps?
Well,
yeah.
It's kind of what we were
like
mocking up there, yeah.
But have you had a huge amount of business out of things like this?
Look, I haven't been running for very long.
How long have you been doing this?
A year and a half.
Okay.
And I took a decision that what I wanted to do was I wanted to grow organically. So no marketing. I don't have a website. I don't get out there.
But you've got a blog.
Yeah, you obviously didn't read it because it's all about my music.
Okay. No, I didn't.
I just thought that, you know, you can't put together a bio and not have your website. But the website is just a media player and it's my music, right?
That's it. What kind of music do you do?
Oh man, I like a lot of stuff. So, and because
well,
I don't do
eclectic.
It for a living, yeah, it is ridiculously eclectic.
So you're not interested in appealing to everyone?
No, I just like making songs.
Right,
that's it. I just like making.
It's
songs.
Purely the creative process that you're
it's
interested
fun.
In.
And that's when I finish creating them, I have no interest in playing them again either.
That's awesome. I was talking to someone just yesterday about the difference between those people who create things, even if they're imperfect, and then leave them and move on to the next thing. And those people who sit and they fidget and they change and they will polish and make adaptations to the most minute part of every creation they make, and they never get to a point where they're satisfied with it.
Isn't that fantastic, though?
Both of them.
But if you can imagine that as individuals, you both have problems in that scenario.
Absolutely. But together, both are amazing. And I mean, you end up with, and the example that was given in a Malcolm Gladwell podcast I listened to was Picasso on the one hand, who would paint a painting in 20 minutes and be able to sell it for millions. And it was, to him, it was satisfactory. He was never really interested in perfecting it. It was good enough. You know, a lot of his stuff was also about interpretation and immediate creativity. And then you had someone like Cezanne who would take a painting, he'd do a little bit of it, he'd put it away, he'd come back to it about 3 weeks later, do a little bit more, and then he'd change it, and then he wouldn't want to sell it because it wasn't perfect, and then this color didn't work for him, so he'd just tear it up and start again. There's so many ways of being a creative human being, and neither of them, in this case, the two that we've mentioned, is correct.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's also, I mean, you start talking about dualism, this idea that there's a wrong way and a right way.
Yeah.
And we're all attached to this.
Well, we have
there's
to be
only
because
two ways of doing things.
Because we're pattern-seeking mammals, right?
Yeah.
When we evolved off the savannah, the only way to survive is to figure out whether this is going to kill you or keep you alive. So we like to have very simple answers to questions. Is it going to go my way? Yes, no.
Yeah, but we also have now, I think, the ability collectively to deal with the complexity of it.
But we have to fix ourselves and be prepared to listen to those complexities, not look for the easy answer.
But we also need to acknowledge ourselves that we're not nearly as broken as we sometimes think.
Well, there's a positive note to end it on, finally, after all this.
But it was fun.
No, it was. It was great. Nice to talk to you. We covered a lot of different things. Man, this is very, very cool. All right. So we're not here to market you. That's not what you wanted. Mm-hmm. But you are in Gerardsville. God alone knows where that is. It sounds
6 km north of Diepsloot. Lovely community. Don't come and buy there. We like it quiet.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't want people to come there?
No, we
stay
like
away.
People being around.
All right. Well, you know what? Don't get in his way if you don't like it. All right, everybody. Thank you for joining us this morning. Thank you to Quibus Rousseau. And we will catch you tomorrow morning between 6 and 9. Thank you, Mubs.
First day back.
First day back, and we're just getting started. CliffCentral.com.